Nature's Archive Podcast, a Jumpstart Nature production.
Do you remember in 2021 there was big news about cicadas coming out of the ground? It was called the Brood 10 Emergence, and it looked like Brood X when spelled out because it was a Roman numeral. Well, 2024 is going to be another year of the cicada, with the emergence of two different periodical cicada groups or broods at the same time, roughly in late April to early May. Now, throughout much of the world, cicadas serenade us in the summer afternoons. You might be familiar with that and wonder, what's the big deal about this? But in a few special locations, periodical cicadas emerge on a specific cycle every 13 or 17 years. And these emergences are like clockwork. Somehow the insects know exactly when to come out of the ground in synchrony with each other across a vast geography. But it gets better still. Multiple species of cicada emerge together at the same time on these intervals, sometimes in massive numbers approaching 1.5 million per acre of land. And weirder still, these same species might emerge on a totally different schedule, offset by years in areas just a few hundred miles away. So what's going on here? Well, this is just the start when it comes to the amazing aspects of cicadas. And today's guest, Dr. Chris Simon, is perhaps the world's expert on cicadas. She joined me for an incredible, wide-ranging discussion all the way from New Zealand. Dr. Simon has been studying cicadas for decades. She is a professor in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Connecticut and has a list of accolades so long I could spend several minutes reading them. So get ready to learn why these broods of cicadas emerge as they do, how glaciation influenced their locations, why 13-year cicadas tend to occur further south than 17-year cicadas, and of course, how you can see them too. You can find more about Dr. Simon at cicadas.ucon.edu, and that's spelled U-C-O-N-N for University of Connecticut. And if you're interested in helping contribute to research on cicadas, download the Cicada Safari app from Apple or Google, and there's more on that in the episode. So without further delay, Dr. Chris Simon. Dr. Simon, I am so excited to have you here today for Nature's Archive.
Thank you. It's fun to be here.
I'm going to jump right in, and I think we'll meander around a little bit and hear about how you got to the position that you're in. But I'm going to start with, how did you get interested in cicadas?
I was always interested in insects as a kid. I was always playing with lightning bugs and ladybugs and ants. But cicadas specifically, it was because when I was an undergraduate taking lots of biology classes, I got interested in the question of what is a species. And I went around asking my various professors and they said, oh, that's a difficult question. So I decided that for my PhD thesis, I would study speciation. I thought if I was going to study speciation, I needed to study something that was in the process of forming new species. I read the literature on closely related species and I found periodical cicadas. And they were ideal because they're broken up into year classes. So each species has a whole bunch of reproductively isolated groups. And these are so recently isolated in different years that they haven't formed new species yet, but they're in the process of becoming species because they're reproductively isolated. And so I decided I would study them.
And I think that's really, it's fascinating because I think for me, I don't have an academic background in biology, but I've been trying to catch up. I've been taking classes and reading and interviewing people like yourself. And you hear about like a proximal separation where species are separated by land, by oceans, their island biogeography.
Right.
But this is a really unique case because they're separated by time.
Right. It's called allochronic speciation. Allochronic separation.
Are there other cases like this, or is it mainly just cicadas that are separated in this way?
No, there's a lot of periodical insects that come out in either even or odd years, and so they're separated in time. The even populations are separated from the odd populations, and there are some insects where in one species, some populations come out in the fall and others come out in the spring, or in the past, that was what caused speciation between two different species. So yeah, there's other examples of temporal speciation.
Right. And when you discovered this sort of natural experiment of speciation in progress, Were you already familiar with cicadas? Did you grow up around cicadas?
I had seen the periodical cicadas only once when in 1962, Brutu was at my grandmother's house. My father pointed out these cicadas to me sitting on the tree, and he said, "These insects are 17 years old." And I thought, wow, that's weird. Where I lived on Long Island, I guess there were cicadas, but not that many. They weren't that obvious. The periodical cicadas are on Long Island, but I didn't live in a patch of periodical cicadas. They were farther east.
That actually leads to a question for me. I grew up in Omaha, Nebraska. Uh-huh. And when I look at the range maps for the periodical cicadas, they're just barely on the edge of...
Omaha. Yep.
Yeah. But I don't remember them. I don't know that I was aware when I was a kid, but I know the sound of cicadas, and I think those are the annual cicadas.
So, right. Did you live there for 17 years?
Good question. Between Omaha and where I went to school, which was in Lincoln, which is basically down the road.
Yeah.
I was there for about 18 years.
Uh-huh.
So I should have seen them.
They were there in 1981.
Okay.
And they were there in 1998.
That explains it. In 1981, I would have been too young to have any awareness, and I was gone by 1998. So.
Oh, that's too bad.
So now here's my ignorant question, though. Are they obviously different to a layperson?
Different from what?
Annual cicadas.
Ah, they're spring cicadas. And they're small and black with red eyes. None of the annual cicadas in the United States have red eyes. And there's huge numbers of them all over. When they first come out, you can see them all over the trees and bushes. And then they climb up into the tops of the trees. Whereas annual cicadas in the United States typically don't do that. Although out west, a lot of the species out west do come out in large numbers some years. They're sort of incipient periodicity.
Interesting. So yeah, I'm familiar with the scissor grinder and uh-huh. some of those annual cicadas. And here, I live in California now, and yeah, right. we have different ones.
Yeah, the Southern California has about 40 different species of cicadas.
Wow. Yeah, I had no idea. I'm constantly amazed. If you aren't studying taxa, you think, oh, it's a ladybug, or oh, it's name your taxa. But then you dig a little bit deeper and you find out there's all this diversity within just that classification.
Right, right.
All right. I really got way ahead of myself there, but I was curious about that. So it sounds like a layperson could understand it was a periodical cicada based on if they can look at it up close and they see the red eyes or the sheer numbers of them, or they read the newspaper and they
right.
they know.
Nowadays, it's all over the press. The media has just exploded. So like in 1979, I think I had two interviews, one in the Wall Street Journal and one in the New York Times, and that was about it. But since then, wow. It's just increased every generation. And now there's just like several contacts a day usually.
Wow. I, again, feel honored that you chose to respond to mine. So we already kind of got into the lifespan of a periodical cicada and the fact that they merge. We didn't talk about emergence yet, but on a periodic basis. Mm-hmm. Are periodical cicadas, like I hear 13-year and 17-year. Can you tell me what that means? And are there other periodicities that exist in the world somewhere?
Yeah. In cicadas, there's the genus Magicicada. It's in the eastern United States, only east of the Great Plains. And they come out in the south, the southern part and up the Mississippi Valley, they're mostly 13-year. Then in the northeast and midwest, and then sort of humping over the top of the 13-year cicadas and down the eastern edge of the Great Plains all the way to Texas are 17-year cicadas. But we used to think that they were the only periodical cicadas, but maybe in 2014, we uncovered this little newspaper article, a little blurb that said, World Cup Cicada. And it turns out that in the year of the World Cup, there's a four-year cicada that, because the World Cup is apparently held every 4 years. I think this is for soccer or football. And so the cicadas come out in the year, like in the spring, right before the World Cup. So I found the publications. It was published by a scientist in Northeast India. I contacted him, and it turns out that they also discovered another group that's nearby that's offset by 2 years. Same species, but it's got two broods offset by 2 years. And then in a book written by a cicada biologist about the South Pacific, he mentions a cicada that might be periodical in Fiji. We checked it out, and sure enough, it does seem to come out once every 8 years. We went to Fiji a few years ago and worked with the people there to document it, and it'll be coming out again in 2025.
Sounds like a good excuse for you to go to Fiji.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the word brood. Can you explain in the context of cicadas what that means?
Yeah.
My understanding is it's maybe a little bit different than like a brood of birds or something
right.
like that.
Right. I know. It's quite unfortunate. I can't remember who first used that term. Maybe Charles Marlett. But it's actually just a year class. Yeah, the word year class would be much better than brood, because as you said, it's used in birds to mean the individuals in a nest. But it's a group of individuals that all appear in the same year.
So you picked your words carefully there, a group of individuals. So a brood could be multiple species?
Oh, yes. In periodical cicadas, most broods have three species. There's three different species groups. You could think of them as large, medium, and small species, although the two smaller ones are almost the same size. But yes, there's three different species. They have three different songs to attract mates, and they all come out in the same year, almost every brood. The northernmost brood only has one species, the largest one, but the other broods have all three species, most of the other broods.
Do the three different species tend to emerge around the same time of the year?
Yes, they merge very close together in time, although the two smaller ones seem to be a little bit later than the larger one. But that's because they have this safety in numbers strategy for survival.
Right. I love these conversations because there are so many branching points and so many different directions that we could take it.
That's good.
Yeah,
it's very hard to even write about them because you have to explain the whole thing in every paper.
Right, right. And somebody unfamiliar with cicadas, I think when I first heard about them, I just assumed a brood was a single species. Then you get into this next layer of complexity. And as we'll talk about today, and as you shared with me offline, there's even more layers of complexity in this story.
Oh, yeah.
As well. So how many, in North America anyway, how many broods do you track?
Okay, there's 12 existing broods of 17-year cicadas, but there could be 17, right? Because there's 17 different years between when one comes out and comes out again. So, but there's only 12 that we know of. There was a 13th one, but it went extinct. It was in Connecticut, and it went extinct in the 1950s. Then in the 13-year cicadas, there could be 13 different broods, but there's only three that are well-documented, well-developed. And as I said, they're mostly in the south, and then they come up the Mississippi Valley.
You've already started to describe a couple scenarios, not just in North America, but also these, like the World Cup cicada, for example,
right,
where this number of four seems to be prevalent. The difference between 13 and 17 is four, and so on. And as I understand
right.
it, and we'll talk a little bit more about how or why or what the hypotheses are here in a moment, but as I understand it, sometimes individuals in the brood, their timing gets off a little bit.
Right. Sometimes a large number of individuals will come out 4 years early or sometimes 4 years late. And that even happens in 17-year cicadas and in 13-year cicadas. In 13-year cicadas, if you go to a place that you know is going to be really dense and you go there 4 years ahead of time, there'll be quite a few cicadas coming out. And the same for 17-year cicadas. If you know of a place that in the historical records, it's very dense and you go there 4 years early, you'll see a large number of individuals coming out, it seems to be increasing. The number of individuals that come out early in 17-year cicadas, at least, seems to be increasing over time, because the first record in the literature of this happening, the biologists from the University of Chicago and Field Museum went out to check it out. And they said, yeah, that there was thousands of them. They collected all the shells, but they disappeared in a few days, eaten by birds and other predators. And they did not hear any singing. So right now we're coming up to that same brood that's going to be coming out, brood 13 in Chicago area and throughout Northern Illinois and into Iowa. And 4 years ago, a whole bunch of them came out in large numbers, and they were out for the entire 4 weeks. They were singing, and they successfully laid eggs. And the same thing happened in Washington, D.C. with brood 10, which came out in 2021. 4 years before that, in 2017, there were huge numbers in the D.C. area, but they stayed out the entire time. It sounded like a normal brood, and they laid eggs, and the eggs hatched. And so it seems like there's going to be the start of a new brood that's 4 years earlier than brood 10.
That's, again, fascinating to think about what's going on there and what the implications right. might be. And you know that these are members, early members or late members in the other case, of the given brood because of the location they're at? Or is there some, are you yeah. doing some DNA analysis, or like, how do you know that association?
Yeah, unfortunately, we can't tell the broods apart, even by the DNA. All that we can tell by looking at the DNA is that all the broods are divided into Eastern U.S., east of the Appalachians, Midwest, west of the Appalachians, up to the Mississippi Valley. And then Western is along the eastern edge of the Great Plains, south. That's the Western group. So all of the species and all the broods show this geographic pattern that's a remnant of the ice ages, where they got forced down during the ice ages. All the forests were forced down along the Gulf Coastal Plain, along the blufflands of the Mississippi and the coves of the Appalachians and in the Ozark Mountains. There were little pockets. Then as the climate warmed, the trees moved north and the cicadas moved slowly with them. This is like over thousands of years. So by 10,000 years ago, the trees were pretty much back to where they are now. And the cicadas moved north slowly with the trees. And the brood formation must have taken place after that, because the ice was there before, so they couldn't have been there before.
So in the relatively short period of time where we have records of these uh-huh. cicadas, do you see changes in their ranges occurring?
Yeah, because of human development. When you tear down the trees and you build parking lots and things like that, the cicadas are killed. But luckily, in a lot of areas, the development has been sort of mosaic, where you have patches of forest cut down to make fields. And then the fields were abandoned. Like in the Washington, D.C. area, the cicadas are doing very well in the suburbs, all around D.C. and Baltimore. Even though that's a really heavily settled area, there were fields at one time, and those fields were abandoned. But they left, the fields were surrounded by forest patches, and especially along rivers and streams and creeks. And then housing developments were built in the fields, and people planted trees in their yard. And the cicadas like edges. The females like to lay eggs in edges, and they particularly like small trees because they're rapidly growing and they're going to be there at least for 17 years. So the natural selection has favored female cicadas that lay their eggs in younger trees in brightly lit areas that are going to be growing faster. So the suburbs is just filled with periodical cicadas there, because the suburbs now is full of big trees.
Hey, nature enthusiast, do you want to be part of something bigger? Well, we're building a movement at Jumpstart Nature, and we've just added some new volunteers to help with our podcast and website. But this means our costs are going up too. I need to purchase software licenses to give them access to the production tools we use. For example, one media editing license costs $21 a month. And this is where you come in. please consider supporting our mission by contributing to Jumpstart Nature through our Patreon or direct contributions, or even purchasing some logo merch. Check out all these options at jumpstartnature.com/donate, also linked in the show notes. Not ready to make a financial contribution? Then please share this episode with 3 friends. Sharing what we do is actually one of the very best ways you can help us. Thank you all for your continued support. It's also really interesting. So let's talk about habitat requirements then a little bit. You mentioned that they seem to prefer the younger trees and a couple of reasons why that might be. Are there specific species of trees that they prefer over others? Are there any other kind of microhabitat or specific habitat requirements that they have?
They're generalist species, and they generally don't have preferences. That was studied by Joanne White, who at the University of Chicago, with her major advisor, Monty Lloyd, who'd been studying periodical cicadas for a long time. They looked at overposition preferences, where they lay their eggs, and they looked at all 3 species. And Joanne learned to be able to tell apart the species by what their egg nests look like. So they recorded that, and they did not find any particular preferences. They did find that there were trees that they seemed to avoid. They wouldn't lay eggs in Osage orange because it was too hard. Wood was too hard. But mostly, they laid eggs in everything. However, of the 3 species of periodical cicadas, one of them has a habitat preference for floodplains. So that's the sort of intermediate-sized black one called Cassini group. It's in the Cassini group. And so those live in floodplains. So they're mostly in trees. They lay their eggs mostly in trees that live in floodplains. And there are some trees are more common in floodplains and some trees are more common in uplands. But they're generalists. They don't lay eggs in pine trees. And they don't emerge in sort of solid pine forests. But if there's any kind of understory with woody plants, that could support cicadas. Yeah, they're generalists.
So that's interesting to then pick apart when it was determined that the intermediate species is found in the floodplains, seeing that it is multiple trees are still generalists there.
Oh, but they will occur in the uplands too.
Oh.
So especially in disturbed habitats, you can find all 3 species side by side in the same place. So they're not absolutely restricted to the floodplains, but they're just much more common. And in fact, when I was talking to some biologists living in Missouri, and we were talking about the most common species, they were talking about the middle-sized one, and I was talking about the big one, because in the East Coast and in the North, the bigger one is the more common species. But in the floodplains of the Mississippi River drainage, the small black one is the most common species.
Is there any kind of direct competition between the 3 species when they're all emerging at the same time?
When laying eggs, there's always competition for space. I guess underground also, there would be competition for rootlets. So yes, there would be competition between the different species. The slight differences in size, I don't think would make that much of a difference to the nymphs in the habitat partitioning. They go through 5 stages. Having this long life cycle makes less competition among the 5 different stages because they're separated out in time more. So in the beginning, they're mostly all small, and then you start getting bigger ones and then larger ones and larger ones. But the really interesting thing about periodical cicadas is that even though all the species in a particular area, all 3 species and all the individuals emerge within a period of about a week, they don't grow at the same rate underground. So even though they have an exact length life cycle, they're growing at all different rates underground. So some have to catch up or else just not be ready to come out. And if they're not ready to come out, they'll keep growing for another 4 years and they'll come out. So they have these windows of 4 years. Once they get to the last stage and they're big enough, they've gone through all the changes necessary, they can come out, but they only do it in these windows of 4 years.
That's really interesting too, because the analogy that came to my head there is if you're on the subway and you miss your stop, it's kind of like for them, if they aren't ready, it's, oh, 4 years more. I missed my stop.
Yeah.
Why don't we tie up the loose ends on the life cycle? Because in the course of this discussion, we've already talked about different elements of it. If you could walk me through the life cycle, if there's a difference between 13 and 17 years, we go ahead and cover that. But just what generically, kind of what does it look like?
Periodical cicadas come out in the spring. They emerge from the ground and they've spent either 13 or 17 years underground growing up, but they emerge within just a few days of each other. So the first week of an emergence will be mostly, you'll see cicadas all over the trees and lower down in the vegetation, and then they'll start crawling up into the tops of the trees. The second week of the emergence, the males will start singing. And if you actually look at the individuals, the males come out slightly before the females. And this happens in a lot of insects because apparently the males, by natural selection, are more expendable. And they're very close together, just maybe a few days. In the beginning, they'll be mostly males. And then in the middle of the emergence week, they'll be both sexes. And then near the end of the emergence week, it'll be mostly females. But it takes them a while before they can start singing. So they start singing after about a week. Only the males sing, not the females. And then during the end of the second week and the beginning of the third week, they start mating. And then during the third and fourth weeks, they start laying eggs. They lay eggs, and the males tend to die before the females. So near the very tail end of the emergence, it'll be heavily female biased. That's because the males come out a little bit earlier, so just a few days earlier. Also, the males are singing, and so predators can cue in on the males, whereas the females don't sing, but they do make a little quiet wing flick to the males. When the males are calling, the females will come in close, then make the wing flick, and then they'll orient towards each other, and then they'll mate. So then after the females lay the eggs, they're in the branches for about 6 weeks. And so the eggs hatch later in the summer, and all of the nymphs will just launch themselves into the air out of the tree branches. Oh, and the eggs are laid in slits in the tree branches in V-shaped nests, and each nest has about 12 eggs. Then they go down the branch. It looks sort of like a sewing machine has gone down the branch, and they lay a whole bunch of these V-shaped nests, and then they'll make another nest. And so they'll just keep, they'll make a skip and then start another nest. And if they're disturbed, they might fly to a different branch and make nests. And so those eggs hatch, the eggs fall to the ground as a first stage nymph we call instar. The stages are called instars in insects. And so the first instar nymph is the shortest. It lasts for about a year or less. And then the second stage, third stage, fourth, and fifth all have an average length of about 4 years. But as I said, they all grow at different rates. Some will be bigger than others. And the laggers fall farther and farther behind as you go through the life cycle. So there's much more of a spread in the nymphs as you get older. So say if you dug up a population of 17-year cicadas at 9 years, you might find some second instars, some third and some fourth, or you might find some third, some fourth, and some fifth all together in the same population.
I think we can infer a couple answers, like tying together with some things you said before. So the females lay their eggs in these little V slits, and they're choosing softer, newer growth, it sounds like.
Yes, but not the newest, because that's too soft. So it's one node back from the newest growth. Yeah, and they'll lay eggs in there. We say pencil-sized branches. But the two smaller species, I've seen them lay eggs in blackberry, poison ivy, Queen Anne's lace even. But that's not the typical place that they lay eggs.
And when the instars, when the first instar emerges and they go to the ground, are they then just burrowing straight into the ground to find roots to feed on?
Yeah, they're very tiny. And so some people have described it as they're sort of searching around for little cracks in the ground, but they do burrow down in, they dig down in. And at the beginning, they might just stay up, like if they're on the edge of a park or something, they might just stay up in the grass roots. Or if they're in the forest, they might just not be that far below the leaf litter as a first instar. But then as the weather gets colder, I suspect they probably go a little bit deeper in the ground. work their way down, but they're tiny, so they're feeding on tiny rootlets. And then for the rest of their life, they're generally between about, at least in the spring when you can dig, or in the fall, before the ground freezes, they're generally anywhere from, say, 7 inches to a foot down. That's where most of them are.
So do they actually then go deeper when the ground's frozen?
Yeah, we don't know because we can't dig them up when the ground freezes. Although I guess we could get some machinery in there.
Yeah. You mentioned too that it takes them a while to start singing when they emerge as adults. Mm-hmm. Are they still developing at that stage?
Yeah. When they first come out, the chitin is still a little bit soft, especially on the inside. They generally come out in the evening and they're white. And then they unfold their wings and they pump fluid through, they stretch them out. And then overnight, they harden. And as they harden, they turn darker color. And so by morning, they're often black. But if there's a very dense population, they'll come out night and day. They'll just keep coming out. In a normal population, they come out in the evening. They turn black overnight. But if you turn them over and you look at the underside, you can see that the male and female genitalia are still like light brown colored, not black, and or even whitish. So they're still very soft. It's called tenoral. I assume that the places that the muscles attach inside are also still a little bit soft. And so it takes them a while. But this is only true of periodical cicadas. So in New Zealand, I'm studying these cicadas that live in our backyard in Wellington. The females and males will mate the same morning, the morning after they come out of the ground. So they can mate immediately. And then it takes a few days before the females will start laying eggs. But that's completely different from periodical cicadas, which they seem to do everything slower.
Do the periodical cicadas tend to average to be larger in size than other cicadas?
No. The annual cicadas are bigger, wider, and some of the annual cicadas are much bigger. They're sort of medium-sized cicadas.
Okay.
There's some very tiny little cicadas. Say, for example, we know of some in Australia that are maybe the size of your fingernail. And then there's some very large cicadas also in Australia, New Guinea, tropical areas.
When you said very large, I could see your hands. Was that really how big they get? And maybe you can describe the biggest ones.
Yeah, I didn't look up the exact measurements, but I would guess maybe 6 inches long.
Wow.
Something like that.
I can't imagine that.
They're really big. Yeah, they're really big. And they can be heard from long distances. There's one in New Guinea that's called the Quitting Time Cicada because it sings at night a really loud burst for just a short time, but every evening right about the time you'd quit work.
I love it. So many evocative names in the insect world.
Yeah.
I had the great fortune, I know we're off track from periodical cicadas here for a moment,
right.
But I had the great fortune to travel to Australia a few times.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the years I was there was a really good year for it's a common cicada called the green grocer.
Right.
And
right.
And I mentioned the scissor grinder earlier
right.
as well. There's so many great names.
Yep. And they have the flowery baker, the cherry nose, and you can buy candy in a bag that candy has all the different flavors of 4 different cicada flavors.
Oh, wow. Where do you buy this? Australia?
In Australia.
I missed that. Next time, if I get the chance to go back, I'll look. So I want to get back to their songs here in a little bit. But before we do that, can you tell me what's all the fervor about 2024? What makes 2024 so special?
It's because 2 broods are coming out at the same time, a 13-year brood and a 17-year brood. That happens roughly every 25 years. But most of them don't come near each other. Maybe it's every 5 years that you can find a 13 and a 17 coming out in the same year, but most of them are not near each other. This is nice because they're very close to each other, but we don't know of any place for sure that they're in the exact same trees. We've mapped these broods individually before. Illinois is one of the best mapped places. They were mapped there even before I started working on them. And and they continue to be mapped by other people, including some of my former postdocs who did a lot of mapping there. From all of our maps and all of our data, we don't know for sure any place where they're actually touching each other. They come really close. There could be some patches, but nobody will be able to tell because where they come out together this year, they'll appear and sound identical.
So when you say they come close based on these past mapping exercises, how close do they come?
Oh, maybe less than a mile from each other. Okay. Around Springfield, they're fairly close together. So there's a number of different places, but we don't know of any place for certain that they actually overlap in the same trees.
Is there any idea as to how far a male or a female might disperse from where they emerge?
Yeah, they generally don't disperse, but they can fly. Cicadas in general, even though they fly, are pretty sedentary. Not just periodical cicadas, but all cicadas. They don't undergo these big migrations. They tend to fly around. And if you study a whole patch of forest, which has been done by other ecologists, have studied a big patch of forest in Arkansas, and you can see that over time, the favorite trees for male chorusing will change over time in the forest. So just one down, they're still fairly close to each other, but they don't go somewhere else in large groups. They don't fly in large groups somewhere else unless a storm picks them up or something like that.
So do you expect, I'm going to get back to what makes 2024 special, but do you expect with this like co-emergence occurring then that there will be gene flow between the broods?
There could be. If they do come out in the same trees, they'll sound alike to each other. So there could be, but we don't know if there will be. It's much more likely that you get gene flow between two 17-year broods that overlap. Because in 17-year cicadas, there are broods that we know occur in exactly the same trees.
Okay.
But if that happens, we know that they are always at least 4 years apart. They never co-occur in the same trees if they're less than 4 years apart. But that means that if they come out 4 years early, they'll join the other brood. That's one of the reasons you can't tell the broods apart by the DNA, because they move through time from one brood into another by these four-year changes. And by the way, Omaha is one of the places that we know of a four-year late group of cicadas. There's a park just north of the city. I forget the name of it. Do you remember?
Could it be Neil Woods?
No, that's not it. Anyway, there's a park just north of the city of Omaha where they came out 4 years late in 1985, I think it was. But it didn't happen again. The last time Brood 4 came out in 2015, we waited for 2019 and we contacted the people who work in the park, but they didn't see another emergence four years late.
Interesting. From a biological standpoint, from a natural history standpoint, it's exciting to have this co-emergence with the overlapping.
Yeah.
From a regular person's point of view, are they going to notice more cicadas because of this?
No, it should just be the same densities as normal, but you have to remember that the density can fluctuate quite a bit from one population to another. And also in a single population, it can change over generations. Some generations, there'll be a lot more than others. And when you drive around mapping them, people will say, oh, there aren't so many this year as there were the last time they came out and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Or there's a lot more this time than the last time they came out. An ecologist, Rick Carbon from Davis, has actually studied that. He's gone to the same populations three generations in a row and shown that some can go up, some can go down. The same year, one population will get more dense, another population will get less dense. So it varies over time and across geography.
Let's talk a little bit about the enormity of like a good year. I've seen some really surprisingly large estimates, and it's got to be just really hard to do these estimates, I would imagine. Can you help me or help the listeners and me wrap our heads around the enormity of some of these emergences?
Yeah, the densest population ever recorded was in Raccoon Grove in Illinois in 1956, I think it was, 1.5 million per acre. And that was the small black ones in the floodplain. So they recorded 1.5 million per acre. And in their paper, they recorded the previous studies by other researchers. The river floodplain populations were more dense. And somebody else recorded 1,300,000 per acre, others just 1 million. But then in the uplands, it's more like in the hundreds of thousands per acre. So that's spread out over an acre. But in the really dense areas, it's incredibly loud, especially when all three species are there. Although the smaller two are much louder and much more annoying. The largest one, the Decem group, they have a nice, calm whistle sound, and it sounds like flying saucers from a 1950s science fiction film. If you go into an area and you ask people if they've heard anything, it sounds like a flying saucer. And the cicadas are there, the Decem ones, they'll say yes. So it really does sound like flying saucers.
Let's talk about their songs a little bit more, because I don't know how much of this is myth, how much is reality. You have three species all singing at the same time. Let me pause this train of thought actually for a second. At this time of year, because you said that they emerge in May-ish, if I heard you correctly.
If you're in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, they'll be out in April.
Okay.
In mid-April. The earliest annual cicadas might come in near the end of the periodical cicada emergence. So you do get a few, not very many, other one species maybe singing, but most of the annual cicadas are at the late summer.
Yeah. Okay. So now back to the periodical cicadas. They don't have a lot of interference then from the annuals.
Right.
But I've heard that there's an element of synchrony that happens in their songs when the males are singing.
Yeah, especially for the medium-sized species, Cassinae. And the Cassinae group, when they really get going, yeah, they tend to synchronize and the chorus will just swell all together. But their song has two parts. It's like a bunch of ticks in the beginning, almost sounding like a ratchety sound, like tick, 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 and then a big loud screechy buzz. And this loud screechy buzz will just, when they're chorusing together and they become synchronized, it'll just swell up and be super loud. Then it'll die down and then they'll do it again. But the Decem, they don't do that so much. They might synchronize a little bit, but mostly not so much. And the Decula, do, they synchronize too. So they're just more like a little tambourine. And they will get to be synchronized in the end.
Are there any rationales or hypotheses as to why they synchronize, the ones that do?
Could be natural selection for a great big giant mating display. And the loud noises could also maybe confuse predators.
Yeah, you wouldn't know where to look, I guess. It's just like it's coming from everywhere.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And also very annoying.
Yeah, for anyone in this area who's starting to anticipate some sleepless nights due to the cicadas, about how long in a given night do they sing all night and how long of a period?
Okay, they don't. Yeah. Generally, cicadas sing in the daytime. However, if there's huge numbers and it's really warm and something wakes them up, they will start to sing at night. Like I've been camping underneath them. Everything's quiet. And then all of a sudden you hear one make a little squawk and then they all start squawking together. And then all of a sudden you got this chorus going, but then it dies back down again because it's nighttime. So they will occasionally sing in the night, but they don't normally sing at night. So if people tell you that these things have kept them awake all night, they're probably not talking about periodical cicadas.
Yeah, maybe it's a cricket or a katydid or something else.
Yeah. Something like that. And then, early in the morning, I've also been camping out in an area that was mostly the large species, Decem. early in the morning, you start hearing this quiet whistling sound, and they'll just sort of sit there and hum early in the morning. But then they'll close down, and then when it starts getting more sunny, they'll start singing more loudly. And there are, like, the smaller two species, Casna and Decula, they usually don't start singing till about 10 o'clock in the morning. So there is some division of the airspace. There's often sort of in the middle of the day when it's super hot, it's more quiet. Then once it cools down a little bit, then they'll start loud choruses again in the late afternoon, all the species. So it varies throughout the day. And it depends. If it's raining, you might not hear them at all.
And something I meant to ask a little bit earlier when we were talking about life cycle, as adults, are they feeding at all? Or is it just like they're there to reproduce? They are feeding.
Oh, they definitely feed as adults. In fact, if you walk under a tree full of adults, you'll feel water droplets coming down. It's like rain. And in fact, if you go to Singapore, a tourist attraction is called Cicada Rain. And you can walk through forests on these tours and get rained on with cicadas who are expelling fluid. They feed on watery xylem fluid, and then they eject what's left over out the rear ends, and it falls out as cicada rain.
Would you consider that? I know aphids, for example, will excrete honeydew, you know, sweet.
Right.
Is it similar? Is it kind of like a sweet liquid?
Yeah, it's similar. No, it's not. It's not sweet. Right. However, in Africa, there's one species of cicada that I think does excrete sweet liquid, which is really strange. But online, there's a video called The Queen of Trees. In the video, they focus in on a giant fig tree and all the life of that tree. They show cicadas expelling liquid, and the liquid falls on the leaves of the tree, and then monkeys come and lick it off. And so I wrote to the filmmaker, and I asked him if he tasted the leaves, and he said yes, and he said they're sweet.
Wow.
The liquid is sweet. I know that there is at least one cicada that has a sweet exudate, but majority of cicadas, not so much. Although when you think of it, maple syrup is actually xylem fluid coming up from the roots in the spring. And so that's sweet, but, you know, very dilute. So xylem will have some sugars in it, but generally not as much as that African one.
Where my head was going with this is, anyone who's listened to this podcast knows that I love aphids. I think they're really interesting. And then watching the interaction with ants when they realize that there's this free food that the aphids are creating for them. Is there any, I guess we have the monkeys in Africa, but in the periodical cicadas, are there any other insects or anybody taking advantage of this excretion from the cicadas?
Not that we know of, but it's not just aphids, it's other. So those guys are feeding on phloem, aphids, mealybugs, scale insects, and ants actually farm them. They pick up the mealybugs and the scale insects, they carry them onto your plants, and they start these farms. In fact, in Hawaii, it's really hard to keep any hibiscus alive because the ants are constantly carrying mealybugs onto them and farming them.
And I guess you said not that we know of. And to me, that is a direct tie-in to the community science or citizen science aspect. Because if you have a lot of people out there looking, there's probably going to be some interesting discovery made. So can you tell me about, I know you have an app and maybe some calls to action for listeners.
Right. It's really important. It's revolutionized our cicada mapping. It was developed by Gene Kritsky at the University of Mount St. Joseph in Cincinnati. They've trialed it several times. And in Brood 10, they got over 500,000 verified photographs. So the app is nice because it takes a photograph. People take photographs with their cell phone, and the photograph is immediately sent to the University of Mount St. Joseph. And then he has a team of people who are verifying the photographs. Once they're verified, he publishes that on a map, and he also sends it to John Cooley at cicadas.ucon.edu, and he puts it on our map. And then we can use that as we're driving around verifying the localities. we often have found brand new populations because of citizen scientists telling us about cicadas that we didn't know were there. In the past, everybody just called their county agent when they had a question about an insect. It's county agricultural agents. And so I would contact the county agent and I would ask them to keep the addresses of people who called in. And then when I got there, I would go to the county center, meet the agent, get a map, and then drive out to the farms where the people had reported them.
So much work.
Yeah. Much nicer with the Cicada Safari app.
Right. I was just going to say it's called Cicada Safari, and you told me it's on Android and iPhone.
Yes.
So everyone
and
should be able to do it.
Any app store, and it's free.
And it sounds like the process you have, like there are other apps that people use to track things, like iNaturalist.
Right. Gene Kritsky and his wife, who helps him, she monitors iNaturalist and also adds those records to the Cicada Safari database.
Okay. And that was going to be my question is, do you have a preference? Yeah. Because like, for example, I participate in a lot of events here that we call BioBlitzes, and they're like low touch.
Right.
You just take
we
pictures.
Do those.
Yeah. And iNaturalist is the app that we tend to use. And I'm guessing that's probably not that uncommon. But if people do report cicadas on iNaturalist, that's still useful to you.
Yes. Okay. Those records will be gathered.
Great. So looking at cicadas and the roles they fill in the environment and the habitats and the ecosystems that they exist, can you tell me a little bit about some of the relationships that they do have and some of the maybe ecological niches or roles that they do fill?
Right. So their ecological role changes as they go through their life cycle. When they're tiny little nymphs underground, they're good food for other insects like ants, other tiny insects that are predators. And then as they get larger, they could be fed on by larger predators. But most of the mortality, as determined by ecologists, seems to be in the first and second instar. But as they get very large into the fourth and fifth instars, then they're preferred food of moles underground and other underground insectivores. So you can often see mole activity increasing before they come out. And then the cicadas themselves host symbiotic bacteria that are specialized that live in their guts and make all their essential amino acids. So there's that little ecosystem going on inside the cicada as well. Then after they emerge from the ground, the adults still have those symbionts. And as they're emerging, they're food for so many different kinds of animals, mostly vertebrates, including things like snakes and lizards, but also, of course, cats, dogs, raccoons, possum, and birds, especially birds. There's huge predator activity in the early stage of the emergence that you can see because they're close to the ground. Then as they get older, they climb into the tops of the trees. Since it's spring, it's often cold up north, so they're not very good at escaping from predators. However, farther south, like down in Baton Rouge, I was expecting to see them on the ground the night after they came out, and I couldn't find any. They were already in the tops of the trees because it was so warm. But most of the cicadas are farther north, and they are still hanging around in low vegetation on the first morning. Then more come out the next day and the next day until the emergence is over. If it's very cold, it'll be drawn out for longer. And then once they get in the tops of the trees, there's still food for birds. And it continues beyond that because as they start dying, there's a huge pulse of nutrients into the soil. And that's been studied by Louis Yang at Davis, who's shown the real importance of the cicada bodies as fertilizer for growing plants.
It's the cycle of life.
Yeah. Yes.
And I guess that really helps, I think, illustrate the spectacle as well when you talk about the uptick in the predators and all the animals and snakes and dogs and cats and everybody coming in to partake in the buffet.
Right. North American Indians also used to know about them and anticipate them, and they would fry them and eat them and they would preserve them.
Yeah.
And then there's tons of people now. Nowadays, you can find cookbooks for periodical cicadas and recipes and lots of pictures online of dishes that people have made with cicadas. But generally, they're eaten before they turn black because they don't, this like soft shell crab rather than eating a crab with the shell already hardened.
Right. From a conservation point of view, you mentioned that there was one brood, I think you said in Connecticut, that went extinct.
Yeah.
You know, what's the current status of the cicadas and the health of their populations and concerns that we might have for them?
Yeah, it's highly variable from place to place. If you're in an area like DC, Baltimore, where there's tons of suburbs, they're surviving because there's lots of parks as well and forest patches, and they're doing just fine there. But if you're in other populated areas where the trees have all been cleared and there's a lot of asphalt and highways. So, you know, when you think of them maybe moving north with climate change, it's a little bit difficult in some places because there's just these massive highways, clearing, asphalt. Be quite difficult to move north along the, say, I-95 corridor. But any place that there's continuous connection, they could move north through a forest, but very, very slowly each generation, like once every 17 years, they could move with the edge of a forest or so forth. In some places, they're okay. But New England was 90% cleared in the 1800s by the colonists with axes. And you can see paintings of the countryside at that time. And it's just cleared rolling hills, stone walls, trees along the edges of the walls, but mostly just completely cleared. And that's why the New England populations are so small. Brood 11's gone. There's still cicadas in Massachusetts near Falmouth and Sandwich and on Cape Cod. There's still populations there. And on the end of Long Island, there's still populations there. But they're getting smaller every generation, it seems.
And it's amazing to think about roads and connectivity for cicadas, because again, it's this, in my head anyway, kind of a misconception I think that I had that, hey, they have wings, they should be able to get away. And I've learned, I had Ben Goldfarb, who wrote a book about road ecology and connectivity recently. It's a great book. He had lots of examples of animals that you would maybe superficially believe could cross a highway that just don't. So I guess we can add cicadas into the mix here.
They can cross a small highway.
Yeah.
In fact, they can cross smaller roads. But once you get to like these 16-lane highways, they have a hard time getting all the way across.
So are there any myths about cicadas that you would like to dispel today?
Mostly old myths. The W on the wing, there's a sort of a black W on the wing. That's supposed to indicate war. But since there's wars all the time, it's hard to make a correlation between the cicada emergence and any given war. But that was an old wives' tale. And then other myths, yeah, they don't bite or sting. No, I can't really think of other, some, oh, the name locust. So they used to be called 17-year locust and 13-year locust. And I think they got that name during colonial times because the colonists in Massachusetts were not doing that well. There was just like one plague after another. And then all of a sudden, all of these cicadas came out. They were all over everything. And so they thought it was a plague of locusts, like in the Bible. So that's how they got the name locust. It's not used too much anymore, but sometimes in very rural areas, you might hear people calling them locusts. But yeah, locusts are grasshoppers, not cicadas.
Yeah, it's funny. Now that you mention it, I remember I have vague recollection growing up of people sometimes calling them locusts.
Right.
That would have been in the 80s.
Yeah. And so because of that, they thought they were going to eat all the crops. But of course, they don't eat crops because they don't chew leaves. They just take a little xylem fluid out of the trees and other woody plants.
If you could snap your fingers and get one thing to help progress cicada research, do you want to cover that one?
Yeah, my work has been supported for more than 30 years, maybe 40 years by the National Science Foundation in all different aspects of the works. And right now we're trying to get continuing funds to sequence the genome of all seven species. We've gotten funds. We did one genome, but now we need the money for the rest. So I'm going to be resubmitting another proposal to get funding. And if we can get the funding for that, we can compare the complete genome of all seven species of cicada. And in that, we have four different 13, 17-year switches. So we can look at the different species and compare, is there something that all 13 years are similar in compared to all 17 years that causes this switch? And also we want to look in that same grant proposal, I'm going to ask for money to look at epigenetic effects, like things that can stick on the outside of DNA, like methyl groups that can affect the expression of genes. And so if we can get that next grant, then we might be able to answer the question of how do they count? How do they keep track of when 17 years have passed? What's going on with these four-year windows, et cetera?
Is there anything in the grant process that like public sentiment or anything that like listeners could do to help with that? Or is it just pretty much all up to whoever's making the decisions?
I don't think so. Yet? The problem is there's just not enough money for basic research. And there's a lot of time wasted by principal investigators, scientific investigators, having to submit each grant proposal three times before it gets funded. That's probably pretty common, two or three times. And then it has to be reviewed all those times. And so the government has to pay for the panel. They have to pay for the reviews. All the scientists have to spend their time reviewing all these proposals. And it's a huge waste of time because there's not enough money for basic research.
Yeah.
So I guess people could write to their congressman asking for more money for basic research, right, for basic science.
So thinking back throughout your progression, it could be early, it could be as a kid, it could be recent, I don't know. But has there been any top of head event, could be a wildlife encounter, a book, a mentor that really stands out to you as escalating your interest in the natural world?
Yes, I remember when I was, I think, 7 or 8 years old, my grandmother gave me a science book, and it was about the International Geophysical Year. And it talked about drilling into the core of the earth, and it talked about science in general. That was one of my favorite books. And then my grandmother also took me to the American Museum of Natural History and my brother to see the dinosaurs. But my father also was very interested in the natural world. He used to point out insects to us and birds and take us on walks in the woods to see frogs and turtles and that kind of stuff. So that really stimulated my interest in science.
So at a very early age, you never know. Yeah, you never know how that will resonate throughout a lifetime.
Yeah, I used to do experiments too. I would feed ants different types of food like lemon drops versus potato salad and see how they responded to it and how they took it apart and took it down into their holes. And I learned to train honeybees so that they wouldn't sting me and they would walk on my finger. But that was that wasn't really very good because I was about 7 years old and I decided that if I could knock off the stinger, then they would be friendly. And so I put them in a little jar with some little pebbles and some water, shook them up.
Oh, no.
And sure enough, when they came out of the jar, they would walk around on my finger without stinging me. But I think it was because they were really groggy.
Part of the process. You didn't know.
Right.
And if you could magically impart one ecological concept to help the general public see the world as you see it, what might that be?
That everything's interconnected, and that if you start removing little bits, it might not fall apart right away, but it'll eventually fall to pieces. So you have to be very careful with the natural system and not cause it to collapse.
Yeah. And that's unfortunately a lesson that you either believe in or you have to wait until it happens.
Yeah, right.
And do you have any upcoming projects, anything you'd like to highlight for the listeners?
Our upcoming projects are mainly to continue mapping and filling in any gaps, finding any new populations that might appear in periodical cicadas, and also to continue our genomics work, which I've already talked about, trying to sequence the whole genomes. So we'll be collecting specimens in the field and flash freezing them. So they'll have really good DNA for the genomics work.
Very interesting. And so where can people follow along or follow you personally to stay abreast of what's happening in the world of cicadas?
On our website, cicadas.ucon.edu, they can follow our mapping exploits. We have different mapping teams, and that'll be posted by my collaborator, John Cooley, on the website. And I probably will do some sort of social media. But yeah, we do need to get the word out about the emergence and get people excited about it.
I'll do my little tiny part and try to promote what it is you're doing in my different channels. And the websites you mentioned, the app, I'll make sure those are all linked as well in the show notes.
Okay.
And yeah, I think we hit a lot of good stuff today. Thank you so much for taking the time from halfway across the world and joining me. It's been a pleasure.
Hi, it's Michael again. I have a few credits this week. First, thanks to Kat Hill for editing help. And also thanks to Dr. John Cooley, Dr. Chris Simon, and the University of Connecticut for permission to use those cicada recordings that you heard today. You can find those recordings and more at cicadas.ucon.edu that we mentioned earlier. If you want more amazing cicada content, be sure to subscribe to the Jumpstart Nature podcast. We have an episode all about why biodiversity is so important to life on Earth, and the cicadas are our poster example. You'll hear more from Dr. Simon, but also much more from others, including a fantastic fungi that turns cicadas into what has been called flying salt shakers of death. Now, don't worry, they won't hurt you, but you'll have to tune in to hear more. I'm producing this episode that you're listening to right now in February, so it's hard for me to forecast the exact release dates for this Jumpstart Nature podcast, but it should be out sometime in April or May. Thank you. Thanks for sticking through the entire episode. If you made it this far, I hope that it means that you enjoyed it. If so, please spread the word and share this episode with three friends or groups that you think would enjoy it too. As for today's episode, let me know. Did I miss anything? Was there a topic I should have covered? Let me know at podcast@jumpstartnature.com or DM me on any of my social accounts. I'll do my best to answer your questions. You can find me at Nature's Archive, one word, on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. I also share photography, nature stories, and much more on those accounts, so you can follow just to stay in touch too. And despite being called crazy by numerous friends and colleagues, last year I left my tech career behind to start Jumpstart Nature, which Nature's Archive is now part of. For the sake of myself, my family, and the planet, I need to make this work. So please also consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/jumpstartnature. I offer some exclusive content and perks, and you can start donations as low as $4 a month. Lastly, please also check out our latest creation. It's the Jumpstart Nature podcast. We just completed our pilot season, where each episode reveals an unseen, surprising, or misunderstood nature topic with the help of experts and our host, Griff Griffith. It's entertaining and inspiring, and even reached number 3 on the Apple Nature podcast charts. There's much more on our roadmap, but we need your support, so check out jumpstartnature.com for more details. Thank you.